Hello, my name is Adrienne Banning. I'm your guest host for Total EM for this episode while Chip is out on the front lines fighting COVID. We have a guest with us today that is no stranger to the Total EM podcast, one Ms. Katherine Thompson of IPV Educators fame. Katie and I have come together today to talk about IPV, interpersonal violence, during COVID. Interpersonal violence is up overall, although we don't have official statistics to back that up yet fully. We are starting to get a little bit more information. And we do know that violence is often about control. And with the lack of control that many people have right now, with job loss, with lack of control over a virus that's rampaging the world, could it even be that that lack of control is escalating interpersonal violence, and not just because people are in closer quarters than normal? What do we need to know to help survivors through this time of social distancing and this quagmire of control and loss of control? So, Katie, thank you so much for being here today and helping us to sort these things out.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So we talked a little bit about being pretty sure that interpersonal violence is going up. And you shared with me before we started recording that some of the countries where COVID has kind of come through already have started to share some of their data. Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. So, I mean, we do have some preliminary statistics for the United States as well, but we also have some data coming in from other countries, particularly European countries. So far, what we know is that in Spain, calls to their national or local domestic violence hotlines and law enforcement are up about 18%. France is reporting a 30% increase in hotline calls. Same with Italy. Both Italy and France issued government proclamations that they could basically requisition entire hotels and hotel room blocks to use as temporary shelters for fleeing victims because their shelters were rapidly overwhelmed. And we're seeing preliminarily about the same data in the United States. I don't have a lot of law enforcement data yet, but the National Hotline for Domestic Violence in the United States is reporting about a 30% increase in calls.
Okay, so there's some increases going on. Right now, we're talking about interpersonal violence between adults. And I liked how you highlighted that people are using hotels that are underbooked right now or not booked at all as domestic violence shelters. Is that something that's happening in the U.S.?
So that is happening in some areas of the United States. I've been hearing some kind of isolated local or regional reports of that. But the way that we're operating in the United States right now is that it is kind of on a state-by-state basis. There's not a lot of a really strong kind of United States-wide leadership on a lot of these things. So one of the things that we're noting is that, some states are requisitioning entire hotels to use as domestic violence, overflow shelters. But many are just operating on either their same resources or even reduced resources because they've been forced to close.
Okay. And maybe it's not a bad thing if you don't know that a hotel near you is doing this, because a lot of times what we want to do is keep the places that survivors of domestic violence and victims of domestic violence are staying. We want to keep that kind of secret, right?
Absolutely. And the hotlines are still acting as kind of the central repository of this type of information. And so in order to access traditionally established domestic violence shelters, their addresses are non-disclosed. People have to sign confidentiality agreements to check in there with the intent of kind of reducing, the ability for perpetrators to kind of follow victims there and or kind of stalk them there. Most of the time, no, you would not know that a hotel was using rooms or blocks of room for domestic violence survivors. You would only be able to access that information through either law enforcement or the hotlines for domestic violence.
Okay, so the first point is that domestic violence is increased during this time. Interpersonal violence is increased. And the second point is that there are still physical shelters for people to go to. Can we back up a little bit, Katherine, and can you talk to us about kind of this perfect storm of why this is happening? You have a danger assessment tool that kind of gets used and ticks the boxes for this time.
The danger assessment tool is widely used in domestic violence evaluation. Dr. Campbell developed it probably back in the, I think, the 1970s. She started to notice, she was a nurse manager who was doing domestic violence research as part of her her PhD project. And she started to notice that there were kind of like patterns associated with the particular violence patterns and lifestyle patterns that ended up resulting in homicide for victims of domestic violence. And so she started tracking those, and she came up with a list of characteristics that increase the risk of dying at the hands of the perpetrator at some point fairly recently in their relationship. I think that it's very easily sort of extrapolated to the kind of life that we're living in right now. Not all of the characteristics are going to be, but most notably, some of the things that the danger assessment notes as being kind of things that raise the homicide risk for domestic violence relationships are big life stressors, things like losing your job, having a financial crisis, other things like that. Also, just the presence of children in the home, more so if they are if they're not biologically related to the perpetrator, but nonetheless, like any children in the home raises the homicide risk. Women who are postpartum are at a higher homicide risk in domestic violence relationships. So, I mean, some of these are kind of like directly related to the kind of lifestyles we're living with stay-at-home orders and quarantine orders, because right. they're sort of like creating this pressure cooker where they're stuck together in the same environment and under greater kind of environmental stressors, and having to take care of children and having to school children right. in a way that, you know, they didn't have to before. But also, I think you can extrapolate other ones to see that anything that basically kind of like changes the environment, changes the power and control dynamic within a relationship, like the presence of a new child, anything that's going to change that dynamic is going to increase the risk of homicide.
Basically, we're living through a time when everything has changed and kind of all of those boxes that you mentioned are ticked. So we're really kind of putting it together, like you've said, in a pressure cooker type of situation.
Precisely.
Okay. And we were talking about adults before, but children are not excluded from interpersonal violence by any means. And now kids are home a lot more and maybe being schooled by people who aren't normally schooling them. So we're adding kids into the mix here. And you brought up an interesting point earlier before we started recording that it actually looks that child abuse reports during the pandemic have gone down. But that doesn't mean that child abuse is going down. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. So that's actually some preliminary statistics. I mean, this being with a tiny grain of salt, because, or maybe this is just my personal plug for better tracking systems in the United States for child abuse, but we have a very fractured system for reporting child abuse in this country. And so we are already sort of operating half blind in the area of child abuse, but regionally, child abuse reporting hotline, so that would be like Child Protective Services, Department of Children and Family Services, whatever you call it, kind of in your region, but a government organization that's designed to, you know, weigh in on child abuse situations, they're reporting hotline calls or child abuse reports by dropping by almost 70%.
70.
Correct. 70.
Okay, that's a lot.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, at first kind of stab at that, you go, oh, well, that's just great. That's wonderful.
Right. Everyone's happy at home together. Yeah.
But I mean, we absolutely don't believe that to be true.
Right.
The biggest problem that we've been able to identify so far is that the top two categories of reporters, people who are reporting incidents of child abuse, are basically out of commission. And those top two reporting groups are school teachers and pediatricians.
Right. Okay. So now the kids in our communities aren't going to school and seeing their teachers. Teachers aren't seeing those subtle signs, and they're not having their well child checks.
Correct. Exactly. Typically, like, school teachers might notice, you know, changes in behavior. They might notice like subtle bruising patterns. They may notice like neglect, defiant behavior, schoolwork declining, and they are able to sort of like intervene and hopefully get the child some help before the abuse becomes more severe. Same with pediatricians. They're trained to look for, you know, various signs of child abuse, and they do so in well child visits. But considering that those are not happening right now, or they're happening over limited media like video right. or phone screening, that definitely limits their ability to sort of evaluate those characteristics.
Hmm. Okay. So not that we aren't, as mandated reporters, always on the lookout, but it's important to know that kind of the major front line of those screening for and picking up child abuse have been taken out of the system for right now. So if maybe you are somewhere where you encounter kids in your professional role, to kind of be aware of that and maybe know that there's maybe a little bit more burden put on you at this time, to maybe screen a little bit more heavily or keep an eye out for that while you're doing other things.
Exactly. I mean, I think the most accurate statement is that the front line has shifted. And so the front line has become the places where children are going to be evaluated. And that would be the emergency room and urgent care, or if they are having in-person visits with medical staff somewhere, that's probably one of the most highly utilized resources in person right now for children.
All right. So our feelers are always up for these things. And now just know it's something to be extra sensitive about, even more than ever. So I have a whole list of questions about what's going on. And now that we know the background, what we can do about it. So I'm going to just say the questions and then see where you can fill in those things with your infinite knowledge, your very wide knowledge. Okay, so what do we do? Do we still screen? What do we do if someone screens positively? We know that some of the shelters are shifting. What other resources have shifted and are still available? And so basically all of those things, what resources exist now and how can we help mitigate interpersonal violence now?
Yes, yes, absolutely. So yes, yes to everything.
Do all the things.
Yes, do all the things.
Okay.
No, so screening. Screening is more important than ever. I would actually argue that, and I have argued through IPV educators, that now is really the time. Now is the time to increase our awareness and our knowledge and our screening abilities and comfort levels with interpersonal violence. Now more than ever, I think we commonly hear this sort of argument like, well, let's just wait and see what happens after the pandemic is over. And I say no. I say now is the time to really start developing those resources and to fight for marginalized victims. One of the biggest reasons for that, I think, is that healthcare is basically, at this time and in this day and age, it's a socially acceptable excuse or reason or whatever you want to say for leaving the house. Right. So it's acceptable to go to the emergency room because your stomach hurts or because you stubbed your toe or whatever your reason is for going to the emergency room. That is a good reason to leave the house. Whereas, you know, I just felt like a smoothie and I was craving that green drink. Like, that's not really an socially acceptable reason. And you're more likely to kind of receive some judgment for that. I think that that's one of the biggest things, is that we are even more so than we have been in the past. We're on the front lines of intersecting with victims of interpersonal violence.
Okay. So screening, yes, and more important than ever, it's one of the ways that someone might reach out to you. It's one of the only ways that they can reach out to society right now, in person anyway.
Exactly. Exactly. And not only is it one of the best ways for them to reach out in person, but it may actually be one of the only ways for them to reach out at all. And so one of the things that we know about survivors and how they contact resources is that they typically wait for perpetrators to leave the house, either to go to work or to go on a business trip or to see friends or family or to perform childcare or whatever, however it looks, fill in the blank here. But they typically wait for the perpetrator to be out of the house to do safety planning and to contact resources because it's a lot safer for them overall. But that space very commonly does not exist anymore because they are together all the time in the house.
And so what opportunities do we have there if someone can't wait for the perpetrator to leave? And if someone maybe can't leave the house except for healthcare?
Hotlines are working on it. They have actually thought of a few things. The domestic violence hotlines in the United States, and actually some of the mental health resources in the United States have, like the suicide hotline does this as well. They have actually, before the pandemic even started, but it is proving to be quite valuable during the pandemic, have launched like a chat feature. So you're able to kind of like type to a counselor or an advocate. And that can also help you sort of start to at least establish a safety plan and to know where you're going, like when and where you're going to need to turn if things get, you know, kind of unbearable.
So the hotlines are still there. They're a way that people can access resources and care. And you as a provider can also call and get instruction from hotlines, right? It's not just limited to survivors, victims.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's something I think that a lot of healthcare providers like either don't know or they kind of discount is that they think that, you know, you shouldn't be sort of clogging up the hotlines unless you are a victim in need of services. But if you are serving a victim that is in need of services, then you too can contact the hotline, ask for advice or local resources. RAIN Network, which is the Rape, Abuse, Incest National Network, has a wonderful, and actually I think the Domestic Violence Hotline has one as well. They have a wonderful feature for like typing in a zip code and accessing like area resources, even just from their website. But they're also there to kind of help you navigate the system and help you figure out kind of like what the next steps are, how you can best support your patients. I too am always there for you, for all of you.
Right.
I think that it's important to kind of empower healthcare providers to be able to reach out and ask the questions that they need to in order to help provide the best care for their patients.
We also want to note that we recognize that being a victim or survivor and being a healthcare provider are not mutually exclusive, that you might be a healthcare provider and also be experiencing these things right now. And those resources are there for you in any level.
Thank you for that. Absolutely. Yeah. We just by, you know, being a healthcare provider does not preclude you from experiencing violence. Just like I talk to a lot of survivors from a lot of different like walks of life and backgrounds. And I think one of the common things that I hear, one of the common threads that I hear a lot is kind of like, how could this happen to me? Like, I'm a smart person. I'm a, you know, fill in the blank here, upwardly mobile person. But I think it's important to note that, you know, violence crosses all socioeconomic barriers. It crosses all backgrounds, crosses all genders and walks of life. And so it's really important to note that, like, there's no shame in realizing that you're in a victim situation. Feeling empowered to kind of reach out for resources is important, regardless of your background.
Okay, so if we are maybe recommending some of these resources, we also want to make sure that we're recommending them in a safe way. Do we recommend that people clean out their browser history, delete their text threads if they're having a chat conversation with one of the hotlines or their healthcare providers? How do we help people go back and kind of erase their steps?
Very good question. And yes, we generally do recommend that survivors try to cover their tracks as best as possible. To that end, a lot of like after visit summaries and stuff are written as in kind of like general terms, meaning like, you know, if you're experiencing this, then here's some potential ways that you could go about getting resources rather than being like, here's some information, some of the information you requested sort of thing. And then also, yes, like deleting text threads, deleting browser histories, deleting phone records, voicemails, things like that. I also tend to recommend accessing these kind of resources on a device that you feel is the least likely to have been tampered with. So a lot of shared computers and stuff, it is possible to install like keystroke trackers and other things like that on them. And that may sort of complicate things as far as like what is capable of like being deleted. So I usually recommend like if you've got like a cell phone or like a part, like you can borrow a friend's cell phone or something like that, that would, you know, limit the amount of tampering that could be done with the device.
Good tips. Good tips to know. Katie, is there anything else that you think we should know during this time of COVID about interpersonal violence and empowering our patients or empowering each other?
I think that we are living in unprecedented times. And I don't think that, I mean, as much as I would like to believe that this is going to go away next week,
Me too.
I don't think I'm alone there. But no. I do think that this is something that a friend of mine said recently that I feel is really accurate, is that they feel like they're kind of looking at the first few pages of a long book. I tend to agree with that. I think that this pandemic state, while maybe quarantine restrictions are lifted, I don't think that it is a book that's three pages long. So I think that we are looking at some overall societal changes and adjustments over the next several years to decades. And so I think it's important that we look at sustainable ways both to take care of ourselves, but also to take care of our patients in these times, and consider that to be kind of like a far-reaching initiative rather than something that just kind of patches the next couple of weeks.
Right. The changes that we're maybe seeing and making now are not, some will be quick fixes, but this is maybe just the beginning of some innovations, hopefully, that we put in place to improve medicine, improve society for everyone involved in it, patient and provider alike.
Exactly.
Well, Catherine, thank you for being here today with Total EM. You never cease to amaze me. And this was very important information that you've shared. We will be sharing a few resources that you've provided on the Total EM website for those who want to learn more. And I feel pretty safe in saying that those resources are going to include your contact information. Is that right?
Absolutely. I am 100% there for anybody who has questions or concerns. You are not bothering me. This is my greatest passion in life, is helping healthcare providers obtain education and empowerment in interpersonal violence. So please feel free to reach out to me.
Katie, thank you so much. With that, will you close this episode for us, please?
Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.